Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Last week, been talking about the paramitas, and last week I was talking about panya, metta, upeka. Panya is wisdom or discernment. Metta is kindness. Upeka is equanimity. And I like to think of all of those as a way of connection. When wisdom is functioning, when the reflective mind is functioning, when there is discernment, there is a certain quality of being awake. And being awake is being connected, isn't it? When the reflective quality has some continuity in consciousness, when one is able to sustain that reflective, wise part of human consciousness for a span of 10 minutes. That's connection over a span. You can say that's samadhi. But also it's a connection to how things work, how the mind operates. Intelligence, just intellectual knowledge, isn't necessarily connection. It's an abstract. So we study the Four Noble Truths as a basis for insight, but an intellectual understanding of craving, the abandonment of craving, doesn't necessarily mean we notice it in our own lives. So all of us have seen that we have the theory, but then in our own lives we miss it. We somehow get lost in it or whatever. So just an intellectual grasp of the teachings was very important. So last night at the Quaker meeting, I was talking about, I have a friend, a musician, and we were talking about musicologist and musician. The musician plays the instrument, a musicologist knows the theory. And as I was saying last night, there's also, there are Buddhologists in the world. There is such a word. And a Buddhologist is one who seems to know a lot about Buddhist schools and Buddhist history and Buddhist art and Buddhist iconography. But a Buddhologist isn't necessarily practicing Buddhist. You can have a Buddhologist of a total different inclination. And then someone in the after the talk said, he now realizes he's not a golfologist, that he's playing golf. So wisdom or panya is certainly employs the intellect, but it's deeper than that, isn't it? It's this aspect of connection where we're connected to the way things are, and when we sustain that connection and we combine it with study, with pondering of Four Noble Truths, and we see craving in action, we see the abandonment of craving, then insight arises and wisdom becomes more profound. And so our connection to the Dhamma becomes more profound. Not that we become more doctrinal, but rather the abstract becomes realized in the practical day-to-day living of our lives. And you could see the culmination of that would be liberation from suffering. So wisdom is a wonderful capacity that needs to be employed, remembered, developed, perfected. And then if you think about if you go back to the Four Noble Truths, the opposite of connection, we could say, is alienation. And what's alienation? Well, craving is alienation from the way things are, because craving is this inability, or is wanting things to be other than they are. So not wanting to get rid of something, wanting to have something else. So craving is an alienating kind of energy. And if we believe in craving, craving perpetuates craving. So as I was saying last night, that the law of karma, you could say, is also the law of recycling. Because the more we believe in the pull and push of craving, the more we are alienated from the present moment, because we want some other kind of a present moment, we want another kind of situation. And the more we react through craving, the more we create craving. We recycle craving. The more I act on feelings of self-despair, the more I believe in ideas of self-disparagement, the more I will believe in feelings of self-disparagement. I'll recycle it. If I hate a certain American politician very vehemently, right? And that any amount of hatred then will be recycled into the rest of my life. So even though everyone might agree with me about a certain person or a politician or whatever, and I kind of get off on that, like say self-righteousness or indignation or whatever it might be, everyone around me might say, yeah, you're absolutely right. But if I am imbuing consciousness with a strong sense of self and other, that is going to manifest in another situation. It might not be a political situation, but it will manifest with another person at another time. So I'll recycle self-righteousness, say. It'll just get recycled in the mind. And you can see how unskillful recycling is, just a samsara, the endless wandering of suffering. But there's also kind of skillful cycling, recycling, isn't there? Like if I practice being patient with one negative aspect of consciousness, like just being patient with a painful knee, not hurting myself, but just being patient with a discomfort in my back or whatever, and I just learn how to be patient with that, that amount of patience will recycle into all negative experiences. Whether it's a mental, emotional, physical experience, I'll have the mind, consciousness will have a certain kind of strength and tendency to be more patient with negative things. So there, one realizing that, one becomes more and more, one has a sense of urgency in being very careful. Being very careful of what one thinks, what one consumes, the way one speaks. Not out of any, not out of guilt or fear or things like that, but out of a sense of, wow, there are consequences. And those are the ideas of hiriyotapa, the sense of conscience and the sense of dread of consequences which will be harmful to myself and others. It's a sort of respect for the law of karma, just as one has respect for the law of gravity. When you're on a roof, you're very careful. Very careful. Might slide down that roof, break your leg. So the more one realizes that the intentions that we put into this present moment have a consequence. So even though I might be speaking with a bunch of people and we might be putting someone down, that tendency to put someone down is an alienating tendency. It creates fear, and so the fear gets recycled. So craving is that when we're not aware of craving, it creates strong sense of self and other. What I want to be or what I don't want to be. So let's say the modes of mind which are very self-critical and self-disparaging, that's a kind of a craving. Craving to be another kind of a person. And if it's just kind of ego-based, then I'll never be satisfied. If I'm self-critical and I believe in that self-criticism in an egotistical way, then there'll be another thing I won't be satisfied with, because I'll recycle the same kind of craving to be another kind of a person. Aspiration is different. Aspiration to liberate the heart comes from panya, comes from wisdom, comes from discernment, comes from seeing cause and effect. It's not an opinion about what I should be, it's a realization. When this is condition, that arises. With this, there is that. If I go this way, I'll get that result, dependent origination. And that's wisdom. So wisdom is like connection, attachment to craving is alienation. One way to think about it. But I think those are good words because we use them a lot in our culture. So if we were to put, if we were to take what is on the side of connection, we find all the wholesome states of mind that the Buddha is recommending we cultivate, we remember, we evoke. So metta, I was talking about panya, metta, upekkha, metta is at the very least, it's non-ill will, if we put it that way. It's not like it's not necessarily like liking everyone. This is not, this would be impossible to like everyone all the time, even to like yourself all the time. That would be just a kind of smarmy new age kind of thing. But it's not so much a liking, it's just not abiding in ill will. Ill will is like wishing someone ill. So metta is that connection to what? It's the connection that all beings want to be free from suffering. It's the golden rule. It's a connection to that. And if you think about that, that's not alienating. Even if I dislike someone, even if I find their behavior to be appalling or whatever, and I disagree with it, and I can politically disagree and so on, if I dwell in ill will, I create a sense of self and I create a sense of other. But if I don't believe in ill will and I say, yeah, okay, this person is acting abominably, but yet may they be free from ignorance, may they be free from suffering. It might be hard to do, but you can see that's a connection. That's a connection to everyone's suffering. And that's freeing. Whereas the other, it might be quite clever, it might be quite accurate in some way. It creates a strong self. Another is a force of alienation. And alienation is suffering. So then if you think about metta as that kind of connection, then you also see that it's all very similar, like gratitude. Gratitude is a connection to the moment. There was the gentleman who said he's not a golfologist yesterday, a lovely guy who's a very good golfer, but he's saying for the last, he didn't mention how many years, but it sounded like the last decade, he always begins his meditation with gratitude, and that quickly leads to compassion. And I think his question was somewhat tongue in cheek. He said, "Can I? Is it possibly get stuck in a rut of gratitude, and then don't worry about it?" But you can see, there was a real wisdom in him. He had come across that way of connection. Now this is different than a demand that you should be grateful. This is, I think, I always talk about this, the difference between an ideal and an ideal of what I should be is actually very alienating. You know, I should be grateful is alienating to the feeling that I'm not feeling grateful, right? Whereas connection to the feeling of being grateful is what? You're saying, whoa, there's suffering, there's wisdom, suffering feels this way. I should feel grateful is another form of alienation, because it's a form of ego, because it's a form of self. But to evoke a feeling of gratitude from wisdom, from meditation, is different. Because we can access that. Sometimes we can't. But oftentimes we can if we just have the wisdom, have the time maybe, or whatever it is, and then we can evoke that. We see that's a really strong connection to life, because it's the opposite of craving. Right? Craving is like wanting something different, wanting something else, not wanting this. And then gratitude is, oh, this way. Good. And as you know, I often suggest that when you're meditating, you're living your life and you get caught up in your plans and worries and so on, that moment when you really know you're present, then try to make it a moment of gratitude rather than a moment of self-criticism or just going off heedlessly. Really ground yourself in that awake, connected mind of gratitude. So you can see how powerful that is. It really connects you to the moment. We were talking about beautiful natural places that we've all been, where the mind stops, and how that connection where the mind is silent, that's an aspect of gratitude or love or whatever you want, but you're certainly not alienated. God, why? Because we're not thinking, we're not craving, we're not desiring. We might in 10 minutes then think how we can do this again next year, and we're off again, or how we can build a cabin or a monastery and so on, and then we're off again and into alienation. We're alienated from the waterfall. Why? Because we're thinking self-thoughts and craving thoughts. So the way of connecting, you find that throughout Buddhist teachings. If you think about metta, you also have to bring in the other Brahma Viharas. So you think about karuna, karuna's connection to the suffering of others. It's the opposite of cruelty. Trouble with karuna, it also can go to worry and fear. So I found that this week was really a difficult week for my mom, and hence difficult for me, because she was in incredible pain in her feet. She could hardly, it was like walking on coals. And I really tried to work with this heart, which is very open, but then not peaceful. And why? Why did I find it difficult to be peaceful? Well, I'm not blaming myself. I mean, it's not blame, but just watching my mind is basically I didn't want her to suffer, which is it's very human. Who wants your mom to suffer? But there it is. Called a doctor and sorted it out and so on. And we did everything. It wasn't just a passive Buddhist saying, suffering is this way, mom. So there is action, and compassion has this active part, but not wanting someone to suffer is another form of alienation, isn't it? You think it's a good form of alienation, but when I take it on like personally, I don't want you to suffer, and it's not thought, it's visceral, it's down in the guts. But this is the way it is. At 93 years old, these things will happen. Yeah? And even though one knows that logically, emotionally, it's very hard to come to the last aspect, and that's upekkha. Upekkha is equanimity. Karuna has that quality has that sting in it, where we're so open to beings that when we feel their suffering so much, and we want to get it away from them. We want to take it away from them. I said to my mother, listen, Mom, I'll have one of your feet, you can have one of my feet, and we can hop. So it's trying to use humor again to cheer her up and so on. But just in the practice, that's what we're watching. We're watching, well, what's the suffering here? What is the suffering? Well, I don't want my mother to suffer. So I do everything I can, but this is it. This is the way it is. And so by connecting to suffering like that, what is the connection? That's the wisdom, isn't it? It's the wisdom's like questioning, what's going on here? How does this feel? Where does it feel? How does it arise? What kind of thoughts are there? What's the tension like? Not so much in thought, but through observation. That's the connection again. You're back with the way things are. And then you say, I see, sure. I don't want her to suffer. And then learning to relax that, let go of that, accepting suffering, is the entry into upekkha, into equanimity. And entry into that quite often is difficult. Sometimes it's not. You see some people, like it's a lot easier for someone who is not my mother's son to be a Qantas about it. So some other monk might come, old age is tough, isn't it? It's different. There's a whole different story and different connection, obviously. So we have things which trigger these forms of suffering, and those forms of suffering which are triggered in us then become those forms which we train with to move the heart to a sense of deeper peace through understanding through constant connection, and then through observing what is it that I want that I don't have, and what is it that I have that I don't want. That's the mantra. Huh? And then I watch that. I keep connected to the suffering. Keep witnessing it, welcoming it, until I really understand it. And in that understanding, it's the aso. And the heart begins to let go. And it comes up again. And we keep doing it. Mudita, of course, is the way of joyous connection. So mudita is the open-heartedness to other people's success, isn't it? Other people's beauty, other people's good fortune. And where that can go off is excitement, or its opposite, of course, is jealousy. We can go off into excitement. But just contemplate all the areas of your life when you're connected. When I'm really connected to life with the open heart, I listen. I really listen, don't I? And when I'm with someone, like I see a lot of people, don't I? And I talk with them about their practice. And if I don't listen, then I just have an opinion of what advice I should give them, I lose that connection. I give rotten advice, and they walk away. Thank you very much. The guy wasn't even listening. So listening is a form of connection, isn't it? You just listen to someone. You don't try to solve it. You don't try to fix it. You don't try to get rid of it. But listening is hard when you don't want someone to suffer. You want to fix it. And yet oftentimes people don't want their problems fixed. They just want to talk with someone. They just want to air something out. And we're busy fixing it. That's disconnection. That's alienation from the person. Why? Because we feel uncomfortable, or we think we know the answer, many kinds of ways. And in the same way, we often want to fix our own heart. Oftentimes we don't listen enough, we don't wait, we're impatient, and so we apply some kind of herbal remedy called meditation to try to get rid of our problems, to try to get rid of anger, or try to get rid of fear. But it's kind of the same when I'm talking to someone, I don't want that to be there. And that's alienation again, that's craving. So actually, listening to one's own suffering, listening to one's own conscious experience, and having enough patience and trust that when there is this kind of open-hearted listening to one's own inner turmoil, solutions arise, insights arise. But those insights are fresh, and they're in the context of what's going on. They're not old cliches that one is applying to the present moment. Otherwise, the whole practice just becomes a cliche, doesn't it? It's just this old, you know, you just kind of throw on top of it some idea. But to the real like connection with our suffering and with the difficulties gives real insight. If one then keeps the practice quite simple this way, when am I connected? And when is there alienation? So much of the alienation, of course, is just the endless thinking, where the mind is just proliferating and problem solving or problem creating. And we need to do a certain amount of that, certainly, but a lot of it is just the habit of alienation. So our training then is to awaken to that very, very sense of alienation that thought can create for us. And if you develop more and more body awareness, you'll see that alienation is very much in the brain. It's a tension in the brain. And then connection is very much in the body, with the heart or with the guts or with the throat. And that becomes a very direct and very immediate way of noticing alienation and connection. If you're talking with a person and you're connected to what your body is doing, and you start to get impatient with them because they're talking too much, or you start to get you already know what you need to do, your heart's not open, you're in your head, you're in your tents or whatever it is. So then the training of body awareness is is the way of connection also. So the more one practices wakefulness of body energies, how body energies manifest when there is alienation, how body energies manifest when there is connection, that becomes a part of wisdom then. Right? So the wisdom isn't just a set of Buddhist ideas, it becomes embodied wisdom. You know in your own body, this is alienation, this is attachment. You know in your own body, this is letting go. This is openness, this is connection, you just know. And so wisdom becomes an intuitive process which gets refined and which manifests in body wisdom, in emotion wisdom. So what was his name? Daniel Goleman? Is that his name? Goleman. He wrote that, the emotional intelligence, I didn't read it. But just the title makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Where a person can be a Buddhologist, but he'd be emotionally very stupid. And so their intelligence is not just an idea. You know, it's throughout us, it's throughout our being. But the way we deepen that is through constant connection, awakeness to the body, to the heart, to the mind, and to everything. And then the process of letting go becomes more and more astute. What was Joseph's? Joseph Goldstein had a line. He says the number of awakened moments per minute, he called them APMs or something like that. Whereas when we started our practice, maybe we had one awakened moment per day, and then it got to one awoken moment per hour, and then how many awoken APMs do you have in a minute or something like that, right? And that's also that, you know, the connection becomes fluid. Ajahn Chah would say it's like, first of all, it's like the drip of a tap, drip 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 drip, until it's a flow of water, and so our practice is always connected, you know, our life is always connected, and then the heart and the body are always giving us feedback, they're always informing us. There's always a lot of there's a lot of wisdom in the body, actually. The body understands tension, feels it. But if we are simply in thought all the time, we don't have access to that. So then the thinking mind is employed to direct attention rather than as an entity in itself. Because the thinking mind, which is an entity in itself, it tries to solve everything in thought, usually just gets stuck in thought. You can't put an end to thinking by thinking. So the thinking mind then, right aspiration, is like, it's the application of thought. It's the application of an idea to the moment, to the body, to the way things are. And that's using thought in a connected way, rather than the disconnection, alienation of I thinking, ahankara mimamsa, I making, my making, which is a lot of suffering. It's a lot of suffering. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection today.
Annamayam dhammakataya sadhu karam dadamase sadhu sadhu.